Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined by Frank Cogliano, as always. And Frank, you're still in Orkney?
I'm still in Orkney. I'll be back next week, David.
All right. You're having a good time?
Having a great time, thank you. Yeah, it's wonderful up here.
Before we sort of dig into our topic for this week, I want to make an apology about our episode last week. I realized after we recorded, we made one major omission in our discussion of presidential pardons. And that is, we did not discuss the custom of the president pardoning the turkey at Thanksgiving.
Yes, I thought we'd wait for that for November.
Yeah, because I think we really need to devote an entire episode to that stupid tradition.
And cinematic portrayals of it. There's a wonderful episode of The West Wing about that.
Yeah, or maybe we won't do that.
Okay, yeah, let's move on.
No, all right, so... approximately a week ago, President Trump issued a series of tweets on, this is on the 16th of July, which
26th.
The 26th, thank you, in which he, the first of the three tweets said, after consultation with my generals and military experts, please be advised the United States government will not allow or accept ... and then there was a pause in which some people thought we were going to war at this point with North Korea or somebody. In the second tweet, transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the U.S. military. Our military must be focused on decisive and overwhelming victory and cannot be burdened by the tremendous medical costs and disruption that transgender in the military would entail. Thank you. The tweet ends with thank you, which I think is quite odd. Anyway, Frank, what did you think about these tweets?
Well, before we move on to the tweets, David, I think we also need to acknowledge that... events have been happening at sort of an incredible speed over the past week. So it seems like Trump's tweets about removing transgender folks from the military were a lifetime ago. Because, of course, since then we've had the vote in the Senate to the failed vote to repeal Obamacare and replace it with something, the skinny repeal, as it were. Yeah. We've had the rise and fall of Anthony Scaramucci, the Mooch. As press secretary or in charge of communications director, and we've also had the firing of Rance Priebus and his replacement by John Kelly. I don't think we're going to talk about these things in any detail today, but we do want to acknowledge to our listeners that we are aware that these things are happening. Frankly, we're not quite sure how to provide historical context to them yet, yeah. So we're going to focus on the issue of Trump's attempt or intention, so stated, to ban transgender people from military service, and we want to provide some historic context for that. I do think, in terms of the actual tweets, which was your question to me, they were very, very odd. First of all, there was a 9-minute gap between the first tweet with the ellipsis and the second one, so it wasn't quite clear what he was going to make a policy statement about.
Yeah, some people in the Pentagon supposedly thought that we were going to war and weren't quite sure about what would we follow.
That's right, and that suggests one of the bigger problems here, which is, despite his claim to have consulted the generals, whoever they are, he doesn't seem to have taken any advice with regard to this policy, if policy we can call it. And so I think that there's an issue there. I mean, I think we're going to talk a little bit about this in today's episode. When one thinks about the way that President Obama unrolled basically repealing the don't ask, don't tell policy with regard to gay soldiers, there was a lot of consultation that went on in advance of that. There doesn't seem to have been any consultation that went on in advance of these tweets. The other thing I would say before we try to historicize things is – President Trump cited the cost of providing medical care to transgender service personnel as his justification. And a number of factoids came out on social media. How accurate any of these are, I don't know, but two struck me in particular. One is that the medical cost of transgender military personnel annually is about $8 million. Apparently, you know, for the Pentagon, that's kind of money you find in your couch cushion.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is statistically insignificant. But just by way of comparison, the Pentagon spends $41 million a year, if this fact is to be believed, on Viagra.
Yeah.
And
about the same amount on Cialis and other kinds of things. So it's
right. Yes. I don't. Yes, it's not the brand name that matters necessarily. But also, you know, the cost of Trump's trips to Mar-a-Lago each weekend are about $3 million per trip.
Sure.
So just place this cost. $8 million sounds like a lot of money. It is a lot to you. It's a lot to me. But in the grand scheme of things, it's really an incidental cost. So I don't think in promulgating, making these statements, I'm not even sure we can call this a policy because it's not even clear it's going to go ahead.
Sure.
That Trump's justification that it costs too much actually stands up, really.
Well, so one thing that struck me, and I think this would be a sort of a good segue into sort of trying to historicize this, is he cites two things in his statement. He says the cost, which I think, as we point out, is kind of ludicrous given the things the military spends huge amounts of money on. It's really sort of a very incidental cost. But the other part that he cites is about disruption, you know, and which harkens back to a trope that you know, soldiers won't be willing to fight with people that they see as outsiders, as being, you know, not part of, you know, it's an argument about unit cohesion that actually has very, very deep roots in you know, discrimination within the military.
It does, and the pushback against that is always, and we saw a little bit of this last week, is actually when you're in extremists in a combat situation, you don't care that the person next to you happens to be different from you in certain ways. Actually, all that matters is that you're all wearing the same uniform, as it were, which is always the pushback, and I think there's a lot of merit to that. But yes, that's right. I mean, it was the cost. Yeah.
And I think,
as well as the disruption.
Yeah, and I think the history will prove that out when they said, well, we can't have black and white soldiers serving together because they won't, you know, care for each other in combat, or men and women or straight and gay soldiers won't work together. I mean, the history sort of bears that out, that those fears are not justified. So I thought, instead of trying to historicize this, we might want to look at, you know, three categories of ways in which you know, military service has been expanded or contracted to include different groups. First, looking at African Americans, I thought we'd then look at women, and then at the LGBT community. But before we get
okay,
all
I
that,
mean, sorry, go ahead, David.
Frank, do you want to talk about, you know, what it meant? You know, try to sort of go all the way back, you know, even before the revolution. What does military service, you know, mean in a sort of long historical context in the United States? What does it mean to be able to serve in the military?
Right. Okay. Well, actually, I'm glad you asked that, David, because the point I was going to make when I so rudely interrupted you is even these categories we've chosen take as normative that a straight white male is a soldier, and these other categories are being added to it, and I think that goes to the heart of your question. I think that's important because I think the message Trump was trying to send with this tweet, I don't think this policy, I'm even reluctant to call it a policy, I don't think it's ever going to come to pass based on some of the pushback in the subsequent week from the Pentagon. So I'm not all that confident. But I think this was a message to his core supporters, those beleaguered straight white men, who've been left behind by globalization, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, hillbilly elegy, you know, et cetera. It was a message to them that he's with them, not least because one of the things we haven't mentioned is his spat with Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, who has been seen as the kind of great protector of the rights of straight white men in the Trump administration. And so I think he was trying to send a signal to them. But in answer to your question, even going back to the colonial period, the straight white male head of household who is a soldier serving in the militia in the first instance is an archetypal figure in American history with really, really deep and strong resonance. And certainly during the Revolutionary period, when, you know, Jefferson, you know, valorized yeoman farmers as the kind of chosen people of God, the perfect American citizens. So it's the male head of household who is able to take up arms to defend liberty and who's an independent individual. He's not beholden to anyone. Is the kind of archetype, if you will. That is the norm.
Yeah.
And everybody else has to adjust to that. And there was a belief both that citizens must be able to defend their liberty and sometimes with their lives, and that's why we have this really resonant image of the Minuteman, but also they would be independent and they wouldn't be beholden to anyone. Mm. And the two go hand in hand.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's a reciprocal relationship there where, you know, one of the obligations of citizenship, either in a community or in a sort of broader nation, is participation, you know, in the militia during the colonial era, for instance. You know, that's one of your obligations. You pay your taxes and you serve in the militia. And that's one of the things you do as a citizen, but at the same time, serving in the military is one of the reasons why you are a citizen. So they sort of reinforce each other, that citizenship and belonging in the political polity are tied up with military service.
That's right. And one of the groups we perhaps might discuss today, although I think the three categories you've identified are important, David, deserve most of our attention, are immigrants. Because one of the things, to follow on that point you've just made, one of the ways that immigrants prove their Americanness is by military service. And one of the things that's been really invidious about Trump's policies with regard to immigration, at least some of them, and the ban, for example, on Muslim immigrants, is a lot of people have come, a lot of cases have been identified of immigrants, either legal or undocumented, who've served in the military and are now facing, particularly those who are undocumented, facing deportation.
Yeah.
Or and this is running against this notion that military service is part of what makes you an American. And a lot of people, even on the right, have been outraged by this, saying, well, hold on.
Yeah.
There has to be a category of people who by their service, deserve to stay in the country.
Yeah, I mean, for a while, and I'm not quite sure how the Trump administration is dealing with this, you know, military service is one of the fast tracks to citizenship.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So, you know, with regards to African-American service in, say, the militia and whatnot, how does that play out in the revolution?
Well, to go slightly before the revolution, in the colonial period, of course, it was interesting because in New England, where there were very few enslaved people, and the African-American population, both enslaved and free, was relatively small, there was a tradition in some communities where all adult 17th and 18th century New England was a bit like modern Israel. There was an expectation that all adult males are going to serve in the militia.
Mm-hmm.
And that applied to African-Americans in many cases as well. As you go further south and the population of enslaved people rises, that is not the case.
Yeah.
And this will have – the reason I say this is by way of introduction because this will have implications for the revolution. And as you well know, David – given your own research area, you know, in the South, the militia isn't so much about protecting communities from the French or
it's
Native Americans. It's about slave control.
Yeah.
You know, they are slave patrols, the militias, to a large extent. So there are different traditions in different parts of the colonies. When the War of Independence begins, there are African Americans who fight from the outset, because the war begins in New England. So there's a African-American man named Prince Easterbrook who's wounded in the Battle of Lexington, for example, on the very first day of the war. And when George Washington, a Virginian, takes control of the Continental Army, takes command of the Continental Army in the spring of 1775, or in the summer of 1775, I should say, he's a little surprised to see African-American soldiers at the Siege of Boston. In this kind of impromptu army that has been created that he's now got command of. And Washington, as a Virginia slaveholder, is initially very, very reluctant to accept African-American soldiers into the Continental Army. They do fight in Northern militias in the early years of the war, but there's resistance from Southerners to enlisting African-American soldiers because they don't like the precedent that's going to be set. They don't want to see black men with guns, frankly. They are pushed a little bit on this, not a little bit, a lot, in the autumn of 1775, Lord Dunmore, a Scotsman, who is the royal the last royal governor of Virginia, issues a proclamation offering freedom to any enslaved men who flee rebel masters, and that's an important qualification, who flee rebel masters to, and come to support and fight with the British. So Dunmore's proclamation is a signal to African Americans that the British might stand for freedom rather than the Patriots and the Continental Army. And eventually, in response to pressure and practical pressure, the Continental Army and George Washington will come to accept African American soldiers. And by the end of the war, the Siege of Yorktown in 1781, for example, one of the best units that, that Washington has in the Army from Rhode Island is predominantly African American at that point. And so there's a gradual process that goes on. I mean, I'm doing a little bit of research on Washington at the moment for a new book, and Washington's evolution on this question is very, very interesting. And he goes through the evolution that we see repeatedly in American history, where in response to military necessity, he comes to accept a more capacious definition of citizenship and becomes more tolerant and open-minded as a consequence. So Washington makes an interesting journey during the War of Independence, and some Americans, or some white Americans, I should say, make the same journey. Not all, as you well know. Slavery survives the Revolution, for example. I think that one sees that during the War of Independence, there's a kind of grudging acceptance, and then a kind of dependence emerges during that period on African American soldiers. Yeah.
And I think
you see this writ large in your period.
Yeah. Well, one of the things you see after the Revolution, I think, is when you find those predominantly black regiments from Rhode Island and Massachusetts, that military service factors into, you know, the abolition of slavery in those states after the Revolution. Is one of the arguments for why African Americans should not be enslaved, is clearly they have contributed to our polity in their service in the military. And obviously that was only part of the argument, but that was there.
That's right, absolutely.
One of the things, though, that happens after the Revolution, once, you know, they disband the Continental Army, and once they're sort of down to sort of a peacetime army, is that African Americans are prohibited from enlisting after, I believe, 1792?
Yeah, that's right.
So, I mean, there's a very lengthy period of time in which African Americans are not in the army during the early Republic. Now, part of this is the army, for most of this time period, and you know this better than I do, is extraordinarily small, right?
It's tiny.
It's a few thousand people at most. One of the interesting things, though, I think, is there's a separate tradition in the Navy that African Americans are excluded from military service in the Army, they're always included in the Navy. The Navy, partially because nobody wants to sign up for the Navy, because it's a pretty lousy job, always has African American sailors, and they're never segregated in the ways that you sometimes find in the Army.
It's not physically possible. Impossible,
exactly. Yeah, so
it's
you,
not possible.
So they're usually not in the, you know, they're not the captain, they're not officers, but there's always, the ships are always integrated, partially because it's really hard to have a segregated ship.
That's right. I did a little research a few years ago for a different project on sailors and privateersmen who were imprisoned from the American Revolutionary War, who were imprisoned in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And again, what I found there, wasn't surprising, it wasn't original to me, was that these crews were very, very mixed in ethnic and racial terms, and so too were the prisons. The prisons weren't segregated.
Yeah.
And in fact, the sharpest distinction that the prisoners made was between themselves and what they called old countrymen, which were people from the British Isles who were imprisoned with them, and whose loyalty they suspected. They thought, well, they're not really loyal to us, but they didn't feel the same way about their African-American counterparts.
Yeah.
Again, and many of these privateersmen and prisoners, they were predominantly from New England, and the traditions, the military traditions in New England, were very, very different from other parts of the new nation.
But you see, like, I think you'd see lots of African American sailors in the War of 1812, for instance. On
that's right. And what, so David, I mean, this is fascinating to me, but maybe we need to cast forward. If you're thinking of the mid-19th century,
yes.
the really important story in terms of, or a really important chapter in the history of the integration of the military in the United States is the Civil War.
Yeah.
So why don't you say a little bit about that?
Oh, sure. So obviously, slavery and race are central to the origins of the Civil War, its progress, and its outcome. You know, from the very beginning of the war, African Americans are asking to serve in the Union military. You start to see in 1861 people like Frederick Douglass saying, look, this is a war about slavery. African Americans want to serve to destroy slavery in a war against slavery. The Lincoln administration, though, from the very beginning, is hesitant about, extraordinarily hesitant about having African Americans serve in the Union Army, in part because there's this very long tradition going back to the 1790s of not having African Americans in the Army, but also because there were a number of, four slave states within the Union, and Lincoln, Maryland, Delaware, Missouri, and Kentucky, that Lincoln very much wanted to keep in the Union, worried that including African Americans in the armed forces would alienate and push those states to secede, but also because even the states that didn't have slavery in the North still were pretty extraordinarily racist, and lots of, he feared, white soldiers, white potential soldiers and politicians would be angry about enlisting African Americans. So there's this constant tension in the first couple of years of the war in which African Americans are pushing the Lincoln administration to put them in uniform, and the Lincoln administration being reluctant to do so. One thing you do find early in the war, though, is African Americans, lots of them runaway slaves, serving in other kinds of military capacity. So you have runaway slaves serving in army camps as cooks, as manual laborers, and as spies and scouts. So even before the African Americans are allowed to officially participate in the military, they are sort of de facto serving in the military because they know the local geography. They know where the enemy is, all these other kinds of things. Starting in 1862, though, in 1863, the Lincoln administration has a change of heart. They start to, and this is tied in with emancipation and the Emancipation Proclamation and the Militia Act and all the kinds of things. It's a complicated story. Begins to enlist African-American soldiers. Probably the most famous black unit is the 54th Massachusetts, which, if I think many people listening to this have seen the movie Glory, which gets most of that story right. And the experience of African Americans in the Union Army is interesting. They are in segregated units, so they are in all black units, but they are led by white officers. It was very important to the people, many people in the Union Army, many of whom were hesitant and hostile to the idea of black soldiers, to make sure that they had a white person in charge of them. So, for instance, the 54th Massachusetts was commanded by Robert Gould Shaw. There's a beautiful memorial to him in Boston. And they are, the soldiers are paid less, the black soldiers are paid less than white soldiers are. So they're facing all kinds of discrimination within their own army before they go out to fight. The Confederates respond by saying, look, we don't consider these to be legitimate soldiers. They say, look, black men in uniform aren't real soldiers, and therefore, if we capture them, we are going to return them to slavery. Or, and this is sort of the other part of the Confederate policy, we will execute them rather than keeping them as prisoners of war. And there are a number of occasions, probably the most famous is the massacre at Fort Pillow, in which African-American soldiers in Union uniform are basically executed by Confederates. But many historians have looked at the role that black soldiers play in the Union Army and recognize that, you know, the Union starts to win around 1863, which is about the, you know, was when African Americans start to enlist in large numbers. And, you know, there is some, maybe some relationship between those things. After the war, black military service in the Civil War is really critical in securing black political rights. So if you're looking at the debates over the, especially the 14th and 15th Amendments, the 14th Amendment, of course, grants citizenship, and the 15th Amendment grants voting rights, those are linked very much to African Americans serving in the Union Army. There's great cartoons from Harper's Weekly and other places that depict, you know, black veterans and asking them, why not this man? You know, and saying he clearly sacrificed for his country and therefore he should be extended, you know, all the protections and rights that go along with citizenship.
Right. So then that story continues into the 20th century, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very interesting. One of the things that the centenary of the First World War has shown is in this efflorescence of scholarship, a lot of which has recovered the number of non-white troops who fought on the Western Front, not just for the United States, but also for the other colonial powers, so troops from South Asia and so on. But in the First World War, the United States fights with a segregated army, as it will do in the Second World War as well. But there's a belief that the first civil rights movement, the second iteration of the civil rights, the first you get the first civil rights movement in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, and you've talked about the impact of that war on that. But there's a kind of demand for greater black equality in the aftermath of the First World War, and certainly after the Second World War. And historians of the history of civil rights in the United States have seen a correlation between asking African Americans, and in this case African American males in most cases, to fight for freedom while being denied the full liberty and equality of their white counterparts. And so it goes back to our point of departure, if you will, this correlation between citizenship and military service. And there's a discrepancy that one sees in the Civil War, the First World War, and the Second World War between what the demands that are made upon African Americans to provide service and risk their lives and the liberties for which they're fighting.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I think that happens both in the World Wars and actually in sort of the period preceding them, you know, is that African Americans are often put in very vulnerable positions in the military. They're not given prestige positions. They're often given very dangerous jobs and ones that you know, don't have a great deal of valor attached to them. You know, and there's, so it's not only a segregated military, but a discriminatory one as well, in which, you know, the officer corps, for all intents and purposes, is all white. You know, there's large percentage of occupations that are excluded. You know, there's African Americans have to fight very hard during the Second World War, for instance, to be able to participate in the, it's not the Air Force, yes, it's the Army Air Corps. And probably the most famous example of this is the Tuskegee Airmen, who are black pilots, who have to fight first to be allowed to be pilots in the Army Air Corps, but then allowed to actually fly combat missions once they've been trained. And that's, you know, it's the story of discrimination within the military, not only to pair along with the segregation that's happening.
Right, and it's worth observing that it wasn't just African Americans, of course.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there was the internment of Japanese Americans on the West Coast that took place, and one of the most decorated units in the war, American units in the war, was comprised of Japanese Americans who were, again, segregated in their own unit, not allowed to fight in the Pacific, but fought in Europe. And so the segregation happened not primarily to African Americans, but not exclusively to them. That will begin to change, however, after the war, in part because of the contributions of African Americans and others like the Japanese Americans to the war effort. And in 1948, President Truman will desegregate the United States military by executive order. He does not need congressional support for this, which is important. He does it as commander-in-chief. Ironically, and because President Trump has no sense of history, he undoubtedly was ignorant of this. Trump issued his statement, and we'll call it that, on Twitter on the very same day that July 26th, that Truman desegregated the military in 1948. I mean, that's just a kind of ironic wrinkle in all of this. But do you want to comment a little bit on how things changed after 1948 or didn't?
Well, so, I mean, I think initially with Truman's decision to desegregate the military, there was pushback from the military about this. You know, Ken Royal, I think, who was the Secretary of the Army, basically said, no, we're not doing this, and basically and was essentially forced to resign and retire because he didn't want to play along with Truman's imposition. And, of course, a large number of the military bases in the United States are in the South, which...
Many named after Confederates.
Many, yes. Which meant that, the Army was integrated on the base, but as soon as they left the base, soldiers were encountering a very segregated world. Lots of historians have looked at U.S. military service in the Second World War and connected that with, the development, the sort of the bursting of civil rights, the civil rights movement in the civilian world afterwards. And there's all kinds of ways in which those two things are connected. A small one was when they integrated baseball. The commissioner of baseball said, if African Americans can serve in the Army, they should be able to play, baseball with us. So Jackie Robinson and that whole story.
I don't think that was small, actually, in terms of its cultural impact.
Well, to be sure, but
that's another story.
But it's a small part of a much bigger story,
right,
about
sure.
the relationship between military service and then sort of broader civil rights.
And Jackie Robinson was a military veteran.
To be sure, right. But one of the things that I think you see happening, and this is, I think, true, especially during the Vietnam era, is even though the military is integrated, the disconnect between black military service and discrimination on the home front continues to be a point of tension. There's a famous cartoon from the civil rights era, which is bad to describe on a podcast, but to be it, of a black soldier in Vietnam who was getting a letter from home in 1965, and it says, the heading of the letter says Selma, Alabama. And it's drawing the explicit connection between a soldier fighting for his country that doesn't recognize his own civil rights. And we can think about, say, Muhammad Ali's refusal to accept the draft, in large part because of racial discrimination in the United States. So these are tensions that, even after the integrated military, play out over the next, several decades.
But it should be said, all that is true, undoubtedly, and I don't dispute anything you've just said. To some extent, the military has been out ahead of American society on some issues, and in fact, to a large extent, what you've just said illustrates that point. Although in some quarters integration was grudging and there was resistance to it, the military is good at following orders. And so Truman having issued an executive order, the military more or less came round on it more quickly than American society more generally did, I guess is what I would say. The other thing I'd add to your statement, we see this correlation between military service and the civil rights movement within the United States domestically, but I also think the international situation contributed to it as well, in the sense that there was, Truman issues his executive order in 1948, the Cold War is just getting going, and during the Cold War, the United States was very vulnerable to criticism from the Soviets and their allies, who said, hold on, you claim to stand for freedom. Look at the way you treat African Americans.
Yeah,
and I think the military as a tool within the Cold War, but also to make a statement, a kind of broader cultural statement, there was a kind of pressure on the United States from without at the same time that there was this pressure within.
Yeah. All right. So, we've done a very cursory sketch of how African Americans have fit into the U.S. military. How about if we sort of apply that same rubric to women, Are there any women, Frank, who show up in the American Revolution?
There are. Of course there are. Abigail Adams famously writes in the spring of 1776 to her husband John that he must remember that he and the other members of Congress must remember the ladies when they go to declare independence and create new laws. And women will play a prominent role. I mean, this notion of manhood and citizenship, which we've already talked about, is very gendered. And women have a role to play in that, but it's a subsidiary and kind of ancillary role to help the male head of household. Mm. However, there are women who fight in the War of Independence. Most famously, there's a woman called Deborah Sampson who dresses as a man and serves in the Continental Army. And Alfred F. Young has written a wonderful book about Deborah Sampson. And there were undoubtedly other women who did this. And there were women who supported the war effort. If you will, more, and I'm using air quotes here, but David can see me, but nobody else can, in kind of traditional female ways, in ancillary ways, supporting the troops, raising money, providing nursing care and things like this. And women do serve as camp followers. Now, we tend to associate camp followers with prostitutes, and indeed there are many prostitutes who follow the armies during the War of Independence, but they're also, they serve, camp followers are providing vital labor during the War of Independence, and some men will bring their wives or partners with them. And so Molly Pitcher is a famous famous woman who her husband was wounded at the Battle of Monmouth Courthouse, and she was a water carrier, hence her name. Her name wasn't Molly Pitcher. That was a nickname. She was carrying pitchers of water. And according to legend, her husband went down wounded or killed, depending on which version of the legend one reads. And she took his place. He was an artilleryman, you know, manning the gun. Or manning the gun. Womaning the gun, I should say.
Yes. attending the gun.
Yes, attending the gun. Thank you, David. So there are instances like this, although Deborah Sampson and Molly Pitcher are outliers to a large extent, and women are expected to serve this kind of ancillary role, supporting their husbands and partners who are, citizen soldiers. You get a lot of women who pass themselves off as men during the Civil War, don't you, David?
Yeah. Well, I think in both, the Revolution and in the Civil War, you do have this phenomenon of women enlisting as men, and obviously they enlist as men because they can't enlist as women, And so I think in Samson's case, she is enlisted under an assumed name.
That's right.
And she serves, I think, for something like 17 months in the army, and the fact
she serves for a long time.
Yeah, and the fact that she could serve for that long without— one has to suspect that some of the people who are serving around her figured it out. It's hard to tell. There's one point in which I think she's wounded, and she sort of cuts a bullet out of her own leg because she doesn't want a surgeon to, take the bullet out, because then her identity would be discovered.
We should also bear in mind that that's right, but that these categories seem quite prescriptive in retrospect. Mm. Some of these individuals who served in the Revolutionary War or the Civil War were undoubtedly transgender.
Oh, undoubtedly.
And so there's an element of that going on. So, we see them as women dressing as men. It's probably a little more complicated.
Okay.
Than that.
To be sure. And thinking about the Civil War context, we have, several different motivations that are going on. Some of the women who fight, are doing so because their husband is in, or their sons are in, a particular regiment, and they don't want them to go off without them. Some of them want to fight, but because they don't have, allow women to enlist openly. And some undoubtedly, as you point out, are probably transgender, and this is the way that they're, manifesting that. But, thinking about women serving in the military in a more sort of public fashion, when you get to the world wars, you do have women by the hundreds of thousands serving in the U.S. Military. I think in World War II, the numbers, I mean, in the order of 350,000 women are serving in, officially in the U.S. military. A lot of them are working as nurses or as clerks or as truck drivers. This idea that women, are serving in all these kinds of ancillary roles. But it's not really until after the Second World War that you start, and really until you get into the 1970s, you really get this question about women serving in combat roles in the U.S. military.
Right, well, in all militaries, to be truth. Well, although it should be said during the Second World War, there were a lot of Soviet women who were in combat.
And I think in the First World War, too, there were some. However,
you're right. So in the two world wars, in the Second World War, you get these iconic figures of the wax and the waves, Women's Army Corps and the Navy and so on. And they're largely in ancillary roles. You also, it should be said, get women taking on male roles. And again, I'm using air quotes here, inverted commas. Traditionally male roles in manufacturing. So Rosie the Riveter is an archetypal figure from the era of the Second World War.
Sure.
But you're right, they're nurses or they're drivers and things. They're in ancillary roles. And then in the 70s and 80s, that begins to be challenged, in part because the nature of warfare changes.
Yeah. I think there's a relation. Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
I mean, obviously one of the things that's going on in the 1970s is the women's rights movement in the 70s, the women's liberation movement, which has an impact here about women's access to various kinds of professions that they've previously been limited in. But the other thing that happens in the 70s is the draft ends, that the Vietnam War ends and the draft ends. And I think the relationship between having a all-volunteer military and allowing women to serve, I think, are related. So the draft ends in 73. By 76, you have women serving, being admitted for the first time into the military academies, into West Point and Annapolis and what have you. And I think that is sort of feeding off of this, sort of synergy between what's happening on the political and military landscape and what's happening in the civil rights landscape, allowing women access to military service.
That's right. So I think that's a crucial backdrop. I mean, what we've seen throughout this discussion, and we see throughout this the history of this period, of this subject, is there's a kind of symbiotic relationship between the military and the society at large, which it represents. And sometimes the military is ahead of the society, and at other times it's reflecting the debates within that society. And there's a kind of sometimes in virtuous, but often virtuous circle that's at work here.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah,
and we certainly see that with women. And I think you're very right. You're absolutely correct to emphasize the end of the draft, because once it's an all volunteer force and a professional force, as it were, then those who volunteer are kind of separating themselves from society, and the pressure then is to say, well, how can we deny these individuals who are willing to serve their country the right and the ability to serve their country?
Yeah.
Not everybody is doing this, and they've separated themselves out. And I think we saw beginning really with the first Iraq War in the early 90s, and certainly with the invasion of Iraq in 2003 and the subsequent, all the conflicts associated with the war on terror, across South Asia and the Middle East, is that there has been a blurring of the boundary. There's no longer a front in the same way that there was in the First World War. And so on one hand, what is a combat position and what's a non-combat position? To a certain extent, that distinction no longer exists. Yeah. And so women have been in combat positions certainly in the 21st century, or have been engaged in combat in considerable numbers. However, it wasn't until 2016, it wasn't until last year, that the military officially took the decision to open all combat roles to women.
Yeah.
provided they could meet the physical requirements.
And I think, you know, there's what's happened really since the mid-1970s is there's sort of gradual, you know, expansion there of what roles women can have in the military. And you know, the military's argument in restricting women, it always said, well, it's either this physical question about women can or can't do various things, or the question about unit cohesion, which I think sort of fits in with the debates about, you know, African Americans fighting in segregated units, or this question with Trump's tweets. You know, the military would say, look, you don't want to have women on the front lines because then soldiers will look after them differently than other soldiers, and that really hasn't borne itself out when in practice.
Also, there's a degree to which really, really deeply rooted assumptions about femininity,
sure,
and what will happen to women if they're captured,
sure,
is an issue. And that goes way, way back into practically the Middle Ages,
sure,
or beyond, that women are somehow particularly vulnerable, particularly to sexual predation, if they're captured, and we have to protect them from that.
Yeah, yeah. And I think now there's really only a very small number of positions that women don't serve in. I think there's some special forces and submarines, I think, are the two sort of areas in which the U.S. military continues to discriminate against women. Although I'm betting those are, hoping at least that those will be an antiquated thing before too long.
Right, we'll need to check that, David. I'm not sure if I thought the 2016 ruling opened all.
Yeah, I think they made an exception for submarines simply because they said it would cost too much to retrofit the submarines we've got to allow women to serve on them. You know, but I'm betting the next class of submarines or whatever will be, you know, have appropriate.
Well, one of the ironies being that women are smaller than men generally, and submariners are small.
Exactly. You should make the argument that all the people on the submarine should be women, or at least
that's right.
Small people.
That's right.
Yes. All right. How does the, you know, thinking about this through kind of narratives and the development of this, how does the history of gay people serving the military fit into that?
Well, it doesn't until relatively recently. I mean, again, there have been gay people forever and throughout history, but I can't think of it being an issue, for example, in the 18th century in the way it will be in the 20th century. It really takes off as an issue,
yeah,
not as a presence or a lifestyle, if you will, until the 20th century,
yeah,
an issue for the military. And it's very closely aligned with the Cold War. In that sense, so there's a belief that some because military service is tied up with notions of heteromasculinity.
Yeah.
There's an assumption again: the normative state is a white male, straight man. A straight white male is a soldier.
Yeah.
And that's certainly the norm, the assumed to be the norm, down through the 20th century.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things I think that's different.
But during the Cold War, there's this obsession that somehow people are disloyal.
Well, I looked a bit into this, and you know, the official discrimination against gay people in the military, you know, really reaches a high point even before the Cold War, during the Second World War, in 1942, they officially listed gay people as one of the things that can give you an administrative discharge, which is also sometimes called a blue discharge because the piece of paper you got was blue on it, so you basically kicked out for being gay. And what that meant was essentially it was a way so they could expedite discharging gay people. And this is in part due to some of the psychological research that was flawed psychological research that was going on at the time that listed homosexuality as a mental illness. And one of the consequences of this, you know, 1942, administrative discharges, is that when gay men returned to civilian life, you know, one of the questions that men got asked in the late 40s and early 50s was, did you serve in the war? You know, and can you demonstrate that by showing your discharge papers? And if you had a blue discharge, that effectively outed you as being gay, right, and therefore, you know, provided a way of creating sort of further discrimination against, you know, so not only kicked out of the military, but there are career consequences afterwards in terms of not only getting employment, but also getting a pension and all these other kinds of things that went along with it, access to the GI Bill and what have you. You know, and then thinking about actively removing gay people from the military, I mean, obviously one of the things that distinguishes gay service in the military from women and African Americans is, you know, the ability to closet oneself in a way that, that's very difficult for women and African Americans, at least relatively speaking. In 1957, the Army has a report, the Crittenden Report, that says, look, gay people are a threat to national security. We need to actively expel them from the military. They are a security liability. You know, they're going to be leveraged by communists or some other kinds of nonsense. And so
there's all this fear about blackmail and just disloyalty.
Yeah.
Gay people can't be trusted.
Yes. And so I think, you know, that sort of prohibition on gays in the military really sort of starts in the second, you know, the one that I think that you and I were both, you know, familiar with from you know, the 70s and 80s really starts, you know, in this, I think you're right, Ponyan, that this is a 20th century phenomenon, sort of this witch hunt of gay people in the military, you know, which was quite profound, I think, throughout the 50s, 60s, 70s, really, until the Clinton administration. And I don't know whether you remember this, one of the things Bill Clinton ran on in I guess this was 1992, was ending the ban on gays in the military.
Yes, I do remember that, and I remember it was very controversial. He expended a lot of political capital, and the early months of his first administration were really spent on a debate about gays in the military.
Okay, yeah,
and it was really, I won't say a distraction, but it was the first big confrontation and conflict of the Clinton administration, yeah, in fact, before healthcare.
And, you know, Clinton, of course, didn't serve in the military, and there were controversies about his being a draft dodger and all of those factored into that. And the compromise that Clinton and the military came up with, and I think it's interesting that you have these sort of situations in which, you know, with Truman says that we're integrating, I don't care what you, the military, think here, Clinton, who had no military services, is negotiating with the military about what the policy is.
That's also Clinton's nature.
No, that's a fair point. You know, they come up with this policy of don't ask, don't tell, which officially ended the witch hunt. That is to say that, you know, gay soldiers wouldn't be actively searched for, but at the same time prohibited gay soldiers from serving in the military and being out as being gay simultaneously, which created, it's a policy I don't think anybody particularly liked. It was a, you know, deep disappointment to Clinton's gay supporters, and lots of people in the military weren't particularly happy with it either. And there's all these accounts of you know, as the gay rights movement became more public and open in the, you know, in the 90s, you know, there's lots of accounts of prominent gay service people being expelled once they came out. You know, that's a policy I think lasted until 2011, if I recall correctly.
Yes, that's right. And then under President Obama, to back up, don't ask, don't tell was such a Clintonian policy, and I don't say that in a critical way, I say it as a descriptive way, in that Clinton always believed if he could just get the people around a table, he could get them to compromise.
Yeah.
And it was a bit of a fudge. But given where the country had been on this, I think he saw it as the best he could do. But it does persist until 2011. But what under President Obama? But then, when change comes, it comes incredibly quickly. So the acceptance of gay people in the military and the full acceptance of gay soldiers and airmen and sailors was quickly followed by President Obama's acceptance of gay marriage. And indeed, President Obama was to some extent following the popular view on this, because various states and courts were legalizing gay marriage across the United States at this point to a large extent. And the change, when it came very, very quickly, and it's come in the past decade, really.
Yeah.
And the acceptance of transgender soldiers has been part of that.
Yeah. And one of the things I think that Obama did with the transgender soldiers is he actually went back to the Clinton model, where he, you know, asked the military to do an intensive study to sort of explain how transgender soldiers could be incorporated into the military, or those who are already there can be, better recognized and supported. And Obama, of course, like Clinton, doesn't have any military service, and so I think he's deferring to the military in some places and not so much in others. So what do you think is the future based on this sort of history of integration of people into the armed forces? What do you think that means for Trump's ban, if we can call it that?
I don't think the ban's going to come to pass. I think he tweets things that are on his mind or in response to things he's seen on Fox News. I don't think that he's so... A lot of people think he's strategic about his tweeting and that he's trying to distract from this, that, or the other thing. And I don't think he's that instrumental. I think he was sending a message to his base supporters and people for whom military service is very important and for whom the normative soldier is a straight white male. I think he was sending a message to them. I think the Pentagon was caught flat-footed because it hadn't been consulted, and I think the response of the Pentagon has been such that they've suggested, well, we're not doing this, or we're not ready to do this yet, and because, at least in the first 6.5 months of the Trump presidency, he's shown very little ability to follow through on things. I don't think much is going to come of this. As a personal view, I hope nothing comes of it, but I don't think, and I'm not a transgender military person, so it's easy for me to be kind of blasé about this. I'm not trying to sound complacent, but I think this is one of those things where he's made a statement and he's moved on to the next thing. And, we've had this Priebus firing and the Scaramucci firing and so on. So what's interesting is, of course, the new chief of staff, John Kelly, is former general. He's now surrounded himself with several former generals, and I wonder if he'll be a little bit more cautious in his approach to matters military as a consequence. Yeah.
Although
I think that's something to watch.
Part of me wonders whether Kelly might have been one of the generals he consulted before he did this. But nonetheless,
in his reference to the generals yes.
Yeah. One of the things I think is interesting about the transgender soldier ban, which I think I'm with you, it's probably going to fail because the Trump administration's incompetent. It runs contrary to the general narrative that we've been telling, which is a complicated narrative, but has been one of gradually expanding access to military service. Whereas if military service was the purview of straight white men, and then increasingly is of white and black men, and then white and black men and women, and then, including...
And Latinos and Asians.
And so if it's been a story of widening the umbrella over the past 200 years, this seems to be, one of the very few cases in which we have a step backward. A step of shrinking access to military service, which I think is interesting.
A deliberate step backward, that's right. Because in the past, we've taken these steps forward, and even when the military's been reluctant, it's gone along. So if one thinks about Truman's desegregation order in 1948, and that was well in advance of the Second Civil Rights Movement, and there was no going back, frankly. You're right, this would be a retrograde step, and that seems unlikely to me.
Trying to think of any other point in time in which there has been this contraction, and the only analog I can think of is Woodrow Wilson's imposition of segregation in the federal government right. generally. Wilson, of course, was the first Southerner elected since the Civil War, was a white supremacist in all kinds of ways, and one of the things he imposed on the government, including the military, was segregation and removing African Americans who had been in positions of authority in the federal government, and there always had been sort of second and third tier positions that had been reserved for African Americans, kicking African Americans out of those positions. I think that's really the only analog I can think of contraction that the Trump trans ban would be could fit into.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right, David. Although I would the important qualifier to that is there was an important constituency for what Wilson was doing. In other words, white supremacy was the norm in large parts of the country.
Yes,
and so he had widespread support for that. I think that LGBTQ rights have moved on to such an extent, especially in the past 15 years, that I don't know why he did this, in the sense I don't think there was a huge constituency clamoring for it. I think his core supporters may want this, but that's not the majority of the country.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is that there were a handful of Republican congressmen who came to him and said, "We want to prohibit gender surgery for transgender soldiers." That they didn't want the government money being spent for reassignment surgery. And then Trump sort of took that and said, "Well, if we want to ban that, we should ban all of the soldiers entirely," which is, I think, even more than what those Republican congressmen wanted.
Right.
So, hopefully this crashes and burns like the healthcare bill and like everything else. Show my political cards too plainly, but anyone who's been listening to the podcast this long already knows where I stand on most things.
So, anybody who's made it to episode 25, David, I think has a pretty good idea of where you're at.
Yeah. I don't tend to keep my cards very close to the vest. All right. So we've been talking about this for a long time, Frank. What's your last drop?
My last drop kind of relates to our theme, David, which is I want to recommend Madeline Miller's novel, Song of Achilles, which I'm reading while I'm up here on holiday. And it's a retelling of the Iliad from the perspective of Patroclus, particularly Patroclus's relationship with Achilles, which in this telling, and as most people who read the Iliad assume, was a sexual relationship among others. Mm. There's a lot of gender fluidity, and there's an issue about sexual identity in this, whilst telling the story of the Iliad from a new perspective. It's a wonderful novel. I can strongly recommend it to folks. Came out 6 or 7 years ago. I think 2011 was when it was published, but I'm just getting around to it. It's a cracking good read as well, so I can recommend that. And it draws on a lot of the themes we've been talking about today.
Okay.
What's your last drop, David?
I want to recommend a blog post, but before I do that, I want to sort of contextualize it. A couple weeks ago, HBO announced that the follow-up from the team that brought you Game of Thrones, and I know you're not a Game of Thrones watcher, Frank, but the team that brought you Game of Thrones, their next project, which HBO has greenlighted, is going to be called Confederate. And the premise for this show is it's going to be sort of take place in 2017 or 2018 or whenever they make this show. But it's a sort of what if the Confederacy had won the Civil War and slavery still exists, and what would modern day slavery look like and a modern day Confederacy look like, and there's going to be a third Civil War or some other kind of thing. So they announced this, I guess they may have done it at Comic-Con or something. And since that announcement, there's been all kinds of backlash against this. Many people arguing that there isn't really any kind of, this is a really sort of bad idea to have two white guys create a show about slavery still existing in 2017, and they're worried about a, Game of Thrones-ish kind of modern-day Confederacy with lots of violence and sexual exploitation and all the other things that Game of Thrones does in a fantasy context being done in a very different kind of fantasy context. And so there's been lots of hot takes about this show, which hasn't been aired yet and actually hasn't been written or filmed or anything yet. But one of the more intelligent, I think, takes on this is in a blog post by Nina Silber of Boston University. And I'm going to post a link to her take on the HBO show, or soon to be HBO show, Confederate, and what she thinks about sort of the merits of this kind of counterfactual history on TV.
David, as a Civil War historian yourself, what's your take?
So I'm hesitant to, part of me thinks it's a really bad idea. It just doesn't, the description that the showrunners have provided of the show doesn't sound like a good show. It sounds like their understanding of the Civil War is based on Shelby Foote, which strikes me as troubling on all kinds of levels. On the other hand, part of me is hesitant about critiquing a show that hasn't even been scripted yet. You shouldn't judge a book by a cover or a book by a press release. You should actually wait for it to be a cultural product before you assess it. I'm thinking I can find it very hard to believe that they're going to do this and do it well, but I leave myself open to be surprised. There was a show that a movie came out a while ago by Kevin Wilmot, who is a film professor, called CSA. Have you ever seen this?
No.
It's a sort of a mockumentary style film by an African-American filmmaker about what would a modern-day Confederacy would look like. And it's done in sort of this guise of a news documentary. But they do it, and they have commercials for, like, modern-day insurance, where they have, modern-day insurance where you can insure your family. And they, have the advertisement where the white person is panning off to his wife and children, and your property, and then you can pan over to, show the slaves. And that does it, and it does it in a fairly nuanced kind of way, and one that's trying to, bring up some, I think, meaningful issues. Whether the team at HBO and Game of Thrones can do that with that level of sophistication, I'm not quite sure. I'm more in the wait and see camp, but I'm apprehensive to say the least. So Game of Thrones, I think, as most people or some people know, airs on Sunday nights, and during the last airing of Game of Thrones, the people who were hostile to it made No Confederate trending on Twitter, so they were using that as an opportunity to try to dissuade HBO from actually following through on this.
Right.
All right.
Right. Well, Dave, Frank, we should be together next week.
Yes, too. Next week together. Cheers.
All right. Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.